Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for what feels like an incredibly special episode of the Calcioland podcast. So not only are we coming off two incredible Champions League matches involving Roma and Juve, we have a great guest at the end of the show, first-time guest Phil Shane from BN Sport. Great interview. I think you guys will really enjoy it. We got into La Liga, Serie A, Champions League, and for you guys looking to break into the sports broadcasting or journalism, he has some great tips for you. So we're going to start off with Juve. We're going to have our friend John Solano come to give us the perspective on what we saw from Roma. But it's hard not to start with what we saw from Juve. And I have to be honest, I always prepare these podcasts well ahead of time, and I really didn't give much hope to either of these teams, especially Juve. And I have to say, some of my takes recently have been rather bad. On Monday, I said that Mandzukic looked like a player that was done, basically given a farewell game. I've said in the past that Roma should just blow it up, sell all their players, and start fresh. I also picked on Monday that Roma was not going to make the next Champions League, that Inter and Lazio were going to surpass them. So since I'm kind of on a negative streak, I'm going to turn it over to our great friend Alex, our producer and co-host. And I'm not even going to ask you a specific question on Juve Real Madrid, since my takes have been a little bit off, Alex. I'm just going to ask you, what stood out to you about this game? What were you really looking forward to saying about what you saw between Juve and Real Madrid tonight?
All right. Well, first off, David, I'm not saying this to make you feel better, but I'm not sure many people have had impressive and spot-on takes in the last week, just considering how improbable the last 2 days were. But my big takeaway from Real versus Juve, there are so many things to draw from it, but my takeaway is centered around the talk of the town, Gigi Buffon. Obviously, if you were watching the match, you saw Buffon go absolutely apeshit crazy once that, and by the way, it was a penalty, once that penalty was awarded. Maybe it was a soft penalty, but it was a penalty. And David, my theory on this, and it's not a hot take, but it's something that maybe not everyone's talking about because they're just talking about Buffon in that match and how he reacted in his post-game comments. His post-game comments were almost just as vicious as his on-field antics. And normally he's thought to be a pretty classy guy, but David, I think he reacted like that. Really? Sure, it was an upsetting call for Juventus. They had just made this improbable comeback, and now all of a sudden they're going to lose off of something so small like that. But I think he reacted like that for the simple fact that he does not have the World Cup this June. He's starting to sweat about how am I going to leave this game. And going into the match yesterday, when it started, he wasn't really getting his hopes up. But once the lead started to happen for Juve and he started to get closer, it became 1-0, 2-0, and now all of a sudden it's 3-0. He's human. He's of course thinking, oh my goodness, this is going to be how I go out. I am going to get past Real Madrid. And by the way, Barcelona's out of this thing. The only big team left is Bayern anyway. I could go out winning the Champions League and in such an improbable way. So all of a sudden, his emotions are building up, positive, positive, positive. He's like, okay, I don't have the World Cup, but I could have this. And then that's given. So I think just any time you're watching any sport, your team is down by a lot. You might switch over. You might turn off the TV or switch to another channel. And then you turn back, David, and oh my God, your team's back in it. Then when they lose, it hurts that much more. And I think that's why he went so ballistic, is all of a sudden it went from, all right, we don't have a chance, to, oh my God, I think we have a chance. Oh my God, we have a chance. Oh, and we don't have a chance because of that garbage. So I think the World Cup not being there for him played a part in terms of how out of control he reacted. So that's my opinion. That's what I took from the game, among a thousand other things. But David, what about you? What did you think of Juve and Real?
Well, I'm glad you covered that. I'm going to get into Gigi a little bit, but I'm glad you addressed that. And look, you know, people know on this podcast, we usually rep him, you know, in a positive way. I'm with you. I think you explained it well. Context is really important. And I think you said it well, but I have a but on that, and I'll get into it on my sermon. Right now, I feel like Mike Francesa after a big weekend. I've been putting a lot of thought into this. So my reaction is like, you know, we say that miracles are really rare events. They're not supposed to happen in back-to-back games, you know, in games of that magnitude. As far as I'm concerned, yeah, the last-minute penalty, there's a lot of controversy on that, but I fully believe that Juve lost this round in the first leg. Unlike Roma, they essentially needed four goals and not at home. They had to get that at the Santiago Bernabeu. For me, they had absolutely no margin for error. And it's absolutely terrible to lose a match that way. I think you nailed it really well, but Juve absolutely left themselves no margin for error. I actually do think, maybe I'm in the minority here, I think even had the penalty not been given, I have my doubts that it would have been able not to give up a goal in extra time. I know a lot of people point to the fact that Allegri still had two subs, but I really think Juve was running out of gas. It really reminded me in a lot of ways of that match against Bayern Munich in the round of 16. 2 years ago, very similar. Juve went into the return leg in the opposition's home stadium with very little hope, put in a majestic performance, and then just ran out of gas. We remember Evra not clearing the ball, and they lost that. So as much as there's controversy on what happened at the end, for me, Juve, the biggest regret is how poorly they played in the first leg. And look, you know, as far as the penalty, you know, I think it's a fair recrimination that Juve fans have is that you flip the teams. It's almost, I think most people would agree, it's very unlikely that that penalty would have been given to Juve in the last minute of that match on the other side of the pitch. And I think there is, you know, I could see how some people feel like Juve in the Champions League don't get great help from the referees. I think of the final against Barcelona, penalty kick that could have been given to Pogba. To me, somewhat similar to what we saw the one yesterday. Also, in the first leg, remember Cuadrado, similar situation. He could have gotten a penalty kick there. Even with the Spurs game, we know there was a lot of controversy there. So I think, you know, it's important the context of it. But one thing that I always go back is Juve and Buffon are also the first people to always say in Italy, people use referees as an alibi and people always point to the referees to take away from our wins. So I think Juve could have maybe handled the post game a little bit better. But I think you explained well the context for Buffon. Also, a journalist that in Italy is, you know, a lot of people feel that he's against Juve, Enrico Variale. He tweeted this old image of the Avvocato Agnelli, the historic president of Juve, who for me is the embodiment of lo stile Juve. And there's a clip of him, you know, he's asked about a penalty kick back in the match in the 80s, and he goes, listen, Juve, it's not one of our customs to complain about refs. He goes, that is for provincial teams. We just don't talk about it. We're above it. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, that's the kind of Juve that I grew up in, the Juve that I really appreciate. For me, it was a little bit unfortunate. But again, I get the context of the match. I get what happened in previous competitions. But again, Juve are the first to say in Italy, people talk about the refs to take away from our success. And again, I think, you know, everyone can agree at bare minimum that you could see maybe why that penalty was given. So to me, Juve put themselves in a really bad situation from the first leg. But I do want to take away some positives for Juve. And I'm a big believer that the best way to improve yourself is to always make it as it's your fault if a situation doesn't go your way, even if there's external factors, because the only way you'll get better is if you try to learn and grow from them. And I think there was a ton of positives from what we saw yesterday. For one, this is probably the best performance in the Champions League from Juve in quite some time. Even historically, Real Madrid had never lost in the Champions League or the Champions Cup, as it was called before, by a 3-goal margin at home in 62 years. Juve did it. I think Juve really needs to take away from this match and really start thinking we can beat everyone in Europe, and they really need to start having a better mentality for it. And one thing that Buffon said a few years ago when Allegri came, and he really said, our goal is now to consistently make it at least to the quarterfinals in the Champions League. If you do that consistently one year, you might just get lucky and go all the way. This year, Juve came really close to it, but for me, the takeaway from this match is Juve needs to think about Europe every time they're in it, think about this match and just go on the assumption they can win against anyone in any stadium. So if that's what comes out of this match, that might be a good thing down the road. So Alex and I covered the Juve ledger of the week in the Champions League, but honestly, there's nothing Alex and I could have done on Roma that could top having our great friend John Solano. You guys have heard him a bunch of times on Calcioland. As you know by now, he runs the great IS Roma press site. So, John, I'm going to keep it very simple. I feel like you've paid a huge price for this great win against Barcelona. You've had Isaiah Thomas traded to your Cavs. You now have Bill Simmons as the new leader of the Roma bandwagon. But I still think this victory has to have been worth all this. So tell me your state of mind as a Roma fan after that match and now that it's sunk in. How do you feel?
It's still a little hard to comprehend. You know, almost every day I have a nice glass of red Sangiovese wine. It's tasted a little different the last couple of days. Got a little more body to it. It's still really, really, really shocking. I figured it would be extremely difficult the entire first and second leg, and I didn't expect that kind of performance in the second leg, quite frankly, just because, you know, it was really difficult to read where their state of mind was going to be, particularly coming into the match. I don't know, you know, how many are actually following their form in Serie A, but they've been really, really bad in the league lately.
Yeah.
Their performances have been horrific. Dropped points to Bologna in one of their worst performances. They weren't necessarily horrible against Fiorentina, but they were definitely lacking something. And I hate to say it because this is also the frustrating part, but they get up for these big matches. You know, they really – the frustrating part is they really don't seem to have the motivation when it's not a nice, big European night with the bright lights on. So that's frustrating, but I mean, I would have snapped your hand off, you know, if it meant being in the semifinals of the Champions League. I'm just still so stunned. You know, I think anyone who would have watched that first, like, definitely, I think we all could agree, Roma were a little hard done.
Yeah.
You know, two own goals, a very, 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 very boneheaded move by Gonalons led to the fourth. And quite frankly, once Barcelona scored that fourth, I to be quite honest, I thought it was tie over just because, you know, Barcelona have been very, very strong, not only in attack, but in defense in the league this year. So I thought that the prospect of scoring three goals without conceding was very, very difficult. However, Monchi gave a similar interview like this after the match, but my thinking was if they could go into halftime with a 1-0 at least lead, they would at least give themselves an opportunity. And then you know, I thought that second goal would probably be the most difficult to find because once you get that, you would have Barcelona on their heels. And rightfully, they were awarded a penalty. I still don't know how PK wasn't sent off for that. I watched the replay at least 10 to 15 times. I don't know how he managed to stay on the pitch after that. But the entire, especially that final half hour, just the drama, simply sensational. And look, you know, obviously being in the final, you know, the final four remaining clubs in Europe in the Champions League is huge. But for Roma, the financial aspect, this is really, 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 really important. For as much stick as Italy seems to get for a lot of the marketing or lack thereof that they do. the television deal that they got for the Champions League is actually sensational.
It really is.
It's only behind England. again, I mean, if you were laid out all four leagues, you would probably, you just guess, you would assume Italy is probably dead last. But
yeah,
the TV deal they get is sensational. So all the teams that qualify for the Champions League reap that benefit. And then obviously you have the bonuses from UEFA that they pay out for each round of progression. So just to sort of lay it out, Roma have made nearly $95 million from their Champions League campaign, and it's going to reach, they will reach $100 million once they have their home match in the semifinal round, depending upon who they draw, which is for a club that has been in the crosshairs of financial fair play. I cannot overstate enough how important that is.
Absolutely. Well, listen, John, thank you so much for hopping on. I know you have family obligations. We really appreciate it. As always, everyone should check out John's great work on AS Roma Press. You'll be able to follow the Champions League semifinals on his site. As great as it is for you, it got even better today with Lazio and my boy Milinkovic-Savic getting embarrassed. So I hope you enjoy your Sangiovese and the rest of your evening, buddy. Thanks so much for hopping on.
Absolutely.
All right, David, so as you said, that's John Solano giving us a much better version of what we could have done. Roma, Barca, fully recapped. He sounds very excited still, and rightfully so. But we are looking ahead to the weekend. We'll move away from Champions League for now. We have Serie A on deck. So without further ado, what do you and Thousand Names have for our game picks for this weekend?
So full warning, a Thousand Names sent me these picks before the Lazio match. So I'm going to read them verbatim and we can have a little bit of fun at his expense. So there's some pretty good matches in Serie A this weekend. As usual, you guys know the drill. Thousand Names sends me three picks. I'm going to read them and give you my pick as well. There's another match that I want to discuss and give you a little bit more detail. So the first match picked, Napoli travels to San Siro to face Milan. Now Milan's going to be without Bonucci and Romagnoli against Napoli's fierce attack. So Thousand Names has Napoli winning 1-0 with a goal by Insigne. He says that Lorenzo is going to make the Vesuvius, and that's the volcano by Naples, explode by giving the city another huge joy after Ronaldo's goal on Wednesday. And he points out that Gattuso is going to keep losing in the big matches and that Milan's going to be humiliated. For our listeners in Italy, Milan-Napoli, Insigne, Lorenzo fa esplodere il Vesuvio, regalando un'altra gioia alla città dopo il gol di Ronaldo. Gattuso continua a perdere nei big match, Milan umiliato. Now, I will say, had Bonucci and Romagnoli, or one of them, been available, I probably would have picked a draw, but I think Napoli is also going to be really energized after that win against Chievo, the way it happened, and I think they're going to push forward. So I agree with Thousand. I'm going to have Napoli win 1-0, but I'm going to give the goal to Milik, who seems red hot. Next pick is Atalanta-Inter. Thousand Names has Inter winning 2-0 in Bergamo, goal by Skriniar and Perisic. He says that Spalletti is going to destroy Gasperini's schemes by employing the beautiful game, playing a nice offensive style. In a bold move, he thinks that Skriniar deserves consideration for the Ballon d'Or and that Inter is going to conquer third place. So in Italian, Atalanta, Inter 0-2, Skriniar, Perisic, Spalletti distrugge gli schermi di Gasperini col bel gioco. Skriniar merita il pallone d'oro, terzo posto conquistato. Interesting. Inter's been playing really well. Although the results recently don't back that up, they have been playing well. But playing in Bergamo, actually Atalanta's better in away matches than at home, but I'm going to go with a draw. I'm going to have it 1-1. I'm going to give Papu Gomez a goal, and I'm going to have Icardi getting back on track. Last match, and this is the key one of the weekend, it's the Derby della Capitale, Lazio hosting Roma. Thousand Names has Immobile and Zecco scoring in a 1-1 draw. The two Rome teams are not going to want to hurt each other after doing so well in European competition. Thousand Names, I guess, didn't have Lazio's collapse coming today, but he says that Inter's going to enjoy this result that would really help them, and that the Roman teams are already dreaming about the European Super Cup. Sorry, Thousand Names, that won't be the case, but I actually agree on the draw. I'm going to have it 1-1, and I'm going to give a goal to Felipe Anderson, and I'm going to give a goal to El Sharawi, an Italian, 1,000 names picked. Lazio Roma 1-1, Immobile Zecco, le due romane non si fanno male dopo l'impresa di Coppa. Gode l'Inter sognando la finale di Supercoppa Europea. Another match that I want to bring to your attention for the Scudetto race, you know, Juve still has their lead on Napoli. They're going to play at home against Sampdoria. I have a feeling Juve is going to be very motivated after that loss in the Champions League. I kind of pity all the Serie A teams that are going to face them the rest of the way. Now, one person that I don't pity is you and I, Alex, because we get so many fantastic Twitter questions and support from our listeners. As always, you want to send us in a question for the podcast, please use the Calcioland hashtag. We'll take questions on Serie A, Champions League, transfers for all leagues, movies, TV, music. You want relationship advice? We can do that too. So, Alex, what do we got today?
All right. Well, I wonder what spurred this first question. David, is it time for UEFA to implement VAR?
Okay, so I've really enjoyed a lot of the takes on VAR, and I've tweeted about it, and I really want to say some people think that, you know, this is really a pro-Juve stance. Like, I'm just really fascinated by people's takes on VAR. I have to tell you, I wasn't that crazy about VAR, but after having it in Serie A for almost a full season, I'm in favor of it. Definitely it needs to be tweaked. It needs to be improved. But after you're in a competition that has it, and you go back to watching a competition that does it, and Dre Cordero said that on Twitter, you really feel like you're stepping back in time. And I think all the people that don't like VAR, I wonder how quickly they would change their mind if a VAR decision benefited their favorite team in a huge moment. I bet you that happens. You get along with VAR pretty quickly. Another thought that I have is, if you know, if you've spent time looking at different angles, slow motion, replays, screenshots to kind of decide if it's a penalty or not, or if you're looking for something to kind of reinforce a bias or what you think should have happened with the decision, if you're doing all those things, that's a clear sign you're in favor of VAR yourself. I do think it would be great to see UEFA implement this. I think, you know, Andrea Agnelli, Juve's president, who was complaining about it after the Real Madrid match, in a way, it kind of reminded me of Donald Trump complaining about things on Twitter based on what he watches on TV. Guess what, Andrea Agnelli? Just like Donald Trump, you actually have the power. You have a lot of authority within UEFA. You have a very high presence. That's where you can make it happen. I think that would come off a little bit better than complaining about it after the match. So long and short of it, I'm a bigger VAR believer after season of it in Serie A than I was going in. I can tell you that much. What about you, Alex? Do you kind of like VAR? Because I know you watch leagues that don't have it, too.
At this point, I do like VAR. I think once you have any system where you can get the call, and I say 100% correct with quotes, but once you have that system, it's hard to undo it and watch something that doesn't have that system. So at this point, and also all the American sports do have some type of replay and review system. Originally, I didn't like it because it ruins pace of play, but now I just want the calls correct. So I am pro VAR.
Yeah, I think, you know, and someone else too tweeted me this, and something that I felt, I kind of would like to see kind of the managers have to challenge as opposed to have it so arbitrary. So I think it can be tweaked and made better, but I'm a fan of it and I don't want to go back.
Definitely. I think all the sports can still refine review, but yeah, absolutely. I agree. All right, David, next Twitter question, still kind of hinting at yesterday. Do you think the Champions League referees are biased against Italian teams and favor the Spanish ones?
So look, you know, I'll tell you, I think people have noticed we try not to talk much at all. I think we've done it only a handful of times in over 100 episodes here on the podcast. I don't like to tweet about referee decisions because kind of my attitude is what I always liked was the Stile Juve and Gianni Agnelli saying, you know what, we're above it. We'll leave the complaining on referees to provincial teams. But again, you know, I listed the wrongs that were given to Juve in recent years, this year with Spurs, potentially Real Madrid. We saw what happened with that penalty kick against Arsenal from Milan. Maybe there is something to this. I was actually talking about this topic with our friend Carlo Garganese about this last week. I also wonder if, you know, the Italian Federation, who's had a lot of issues, you know, maybe they're not particularly well-liked. So I go back to the fact that it's up to Andrea Agnelli to really help. He's very well-respected within UEFA. to kind of maybe bring change. I think, look, I'm not crazy about Juve complaining so much about the referees, but at least they spoke up about it a lot. Maybe that will give them more benefit of the doubt calls down the road. But in general, I'm not a conspiracy theorist on referees.
All right. Next Twitter question. David, had Juventus gone through to the Champions League semifinals, would they have gotten half as much love from the other teams in the league like Roma did the day before?
Well, I think the listener was kind of answering his own question. clearly not. I think Juve getting eliminated in that fashion was the highlight of the season for a lot of fan bases. And quite frankly, I know a lot of Juve fans are like, oh, you know, now we need to punish the other Serie A teams and just whoop them and all. But I'll tell you what, the best way to answer all those fan bases and shut them up is actually win the Champions League. Nothing short of that is going to do that. And even then, those people will still complain. So Roma have kind of a lovable losers type of thing. Nobody expected. I'm not surprised they got a lot of kudos from other teams. I doubt Juve would have gotten official tweets from other clubs, maybe a couple like Genoa or whatnot, but definitely not from the fans. No doubt about that.
Very true. All right, next Twitter question. Two-parter, does Juve's performance in the second leg against Real Madrid prove that Paulo Dybala is almost a luxury player for the old lady? And can we say that Roma's win against Barcelona is an indication of how competitive Serie A is this season, or is it an outlier?
So the reason we put these questions together, and I think, you know, both of them are kind of small sample sizes. I think it's a little bit hard to overreact to both. I have a feeling a lot of people have. I do think there is some truth to maybe Dybala not being as clutch as he needs to be in big matches. You know, then he destroyed Benevento, didn't do particularly well against Real Madrid, got a red card. So maybe there's a little bit there, but I think, you know, Dybala's still young. I think clearly Juve is better off with a player of his caliber, but as Yanis Mikhailik, friend of the show, tweeted after the first leg, those matches against Real Madrid should really be a wake-up call to Dybala to realize he has to decide how good he wants to be. As far as Roma, you know, maybe it is an outlier. Not a lot of people, you know, expected him to do it. Interestingly, our friend John Solano pointed out to it how much more inspired Roma is in Europe compared to in Serie A. They kind of seem to play to the level of their opponents. So I think it says more about Roma's mentality than it does about, you know, their strength for Serie A as a whole.
All right. This next question is interesting for me. David, what are the odds Alvaro Morata returns to Juve this summer?
So there's been a lot of buzz on this in the past week. And, you know, there's no reports from the people that I work with or people that I follow. I think, you know, there's always a great narrative. And then look, you know, and speaking of bad takes, you know, definitely Morata has not lived up to what I expected at Chelsea. He seems, you know, maybe the Premier League isn't the best habitat for him. We know he has a great relationship to Juve. Last year, he really didn't pursue a transfer to Milan out of respect for Juve, but you know, I have some considerations as to why I don't think this is particularly likely, at least not now. But again, keep in mind, I never thought Bonucci would be at Milan, and I didn't expect Bernardeschi to go from Fiorentina to Juve. So we just keep seeing over and over again that logic and reason aren't necessarily what happens. But I look at Juve's squad, and you know, Higuain will definitely be there. Just because Mandzukic can play on the wing doesn't really mean that Morata could also do it in that role. So I'm not sure if Morata were to leave Chelsea to go to Juve that he'd have a guaranteed starter's job or anything close to that. The other idea that I see floated around is swapping Alexandre for Morata. I know you'd love that, Alex, but yeah, to me that makes no sense for Juve. Like, I can see there's a decent chance that Alexandre will leave this summer, but if that ship goes, like, Juve needs to reinvest that money in a midfielder. I don't see it as a good idea as playing your biggest chip to improve the team to bolster a position where you're already really deep up front. So if Alexandre goes, I would reinvest that money in a midfielder. And even for Morata, I look at Juve's front line. You know, there's some doubt on Dybala if he'll be on the team or not, but Juve also has to invest a lot just to keep Douglas Costa, and that's something Juve fans might not want to hear. You know, I would really, when you think about the summer plans, you have to account for all the money Juve has to spend just to keep Douglas Costa. So short of Morata arriving on a loan with option to buy deal, I just don't see it making sense financially, but it really wouldn't surprise me in for a couple of years, maybe when Higuain's about to hang it up, that Morata comes back to Juve. That does seem to make a lot of sense for a variety of reasons. So I'd be very surprised if it happens this summer.
Holy crap, David, you have me wanting a swap deal more than I ever have. Oh, God. Bring Sandro to the bridge. Come on. All right, next question. If Torino invests properly on their defense next season, will they be more competitive?
So I'm glad we kind of get a little bit of change of pace from all the top teams. I was looking at Torino's defense. They got a lot of older players, Bordisso, Moretti. You know, Nkolo, who arrived on loan from Lyon, has been quite good. Torino would really like to keep him. I'm curious to see if that works out. In a way, it feels like such a random transfer, how like Torino also got Joe Hart. That didn't feel like he was going to stay long-term, but Torino would like to keep Nkolo. I think he's been quite good for them when I watch him. Now, you know, Torino also had high hopes for two promising young defenders, Brazilian Bianco, who in years past had been linked to top clubs, and they had this defender, Bonifacio, who had done really well at Spal and Serie B. Neither of them really made an impact next season, so I wonder now that Mazzarri, assuming he stays, if he sees enough in them to kind of be the new kind of leaders of Torino's defense. But between the old age of who they have and the uncertain status of Nkolo, those two guys might not be enough. So, intriguing question. I think Torino's going to be definitely one of the teams to watch in the summer transfer window.
All right, last Twitter question. Let's move away from football. David, what did you make of The Disaster Artist, and do you have to see the movie The Room first to appreciate it?
So for those of you that aren't familiar, this is a hilarious movie that James Franco directed and starred in. It did win an Academy Award. I don't remember for what it was, but it's a great movie. I finally watched it. So the long and short of it, The Room is considered the best bad movie ever. There's a lot of bad movies that just aren't good, but The Room is kind of those movies, unintentional comedy. It's absolutely hilarious. I watched it a few years ago. And so I watched The Disaster Artist over last weekend, and I was absolutely blown away. So I don't think you need to have watched The Room. I think in a lot of ways, it might actually be a pretty cool experience to watch Disaster Artist first and then The Room, but it's really, really great. I also wonder if this is going to start a new genre. You look at Hollywood's running out of ideas, they're doing sequels, remakes. Like, could this become a new thing? Like, there's been documentaries of famous movies, like Heart of Darkness for Apocalypse Now. There's been documentaries on great movies, but not exactly a movie made on the way another movie was made. This could be an intriguing new genre, if you will. And I have to say, James Franco, you know, so many people say that he's a genius and he's a little bit uneven, but in this movie, absolutely fantastic. So if you're looking for a great comedy, this movie has it. You'll laugh your ass off, but it's also a really inspiring movie in an odd way. It's a movie a lot about friendship and pursuing your dreams. So I really enjoyed it. I'm going to remember 2017 and Disaster Artist was released then as one of my favorite years ever for movie. Don't just get so hung up on the fact that Shape of Water won the Oscar for Best Picture. I think it's a fine movie. That's definitely not the movie I'm going to remember for. To me, Disaster Artist and Get Out really, really stand out to me as original, great movies. That's what I'll remember 2017 for. We had some great, more classic old school movies like Phantom Thread and Dunkirk. So really, Hollywood is roaring back. There's been a lot of swing on the TV shows. But if you kind of want to get back into movies, definitely check out The Disaster Artist. So now that we cleansed our palate with a little change of subject, we're going to get into a great interview with Phil Shane, who we've wanted to get on from BN Sport for quite some time. I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. I can't wait to have him back on to talk more about broadcasting. And one last thing I want to ask to all our listeners, if you enjoy what we do, please support the podcast. If you're listening to us on iTunes, please leave us a 5-star review. Literally takes 2 seconds. If you're listening to us now on your iPhone, please do that now. And if you're on Android, follow us on SoundCloud, and you can listen to us on Stitcher. So thanks so much. So I'm very excited to be joined for the first time on our podcast. Someone that I've been following and listening to for quite some time, provides great coverage. We're going to call it football on this podcast because of our audience. But he's a fantastic announcer on BN Sports as well as SiriusXM FC. Not only do you can hear him calling games, but also providing great analysis on BN Sports' various shows. So, Phil Shane, it's a real pleasure to have you on tonight. Welcome to Calcio Land.
Well, it is my pleasure. I love what you do on the news gathering. And, again, if you love this game, you want to know everything and you want to know it now. And I appreciate what you do.
Awesome. So what I figured we'd do, Phil, is it's your first time. We have a lot of our listeners that are aspiring.
You have a velvet glove or something?
We have a lot of listeners that are aspiring broadcasters looking to break in the game. After I ask you some questions on what we saw this week, mainly in the Champions League, we want to ask you some questions on your career because we love giving advice to a lot of our listeners. But let's start from what we saw this week, the two Champions League matches. You're an expert in La Liga, of course, on BN Sport. You guys cover Serie A as well. So you're a great person to talk to about what we saw. So let's start with Roma's remarkable comeback against Barcelona on Tuesday. So I want to ask you, which of these two storylines would you say are more true? That Roma had the courage to face Barca head on, and that's what led them to the triumph. I think they were the better team over the two games. Or did Barcelona completely collapse at the Olympico on Tuesday, thinking they already had this in the bag?
I think, as the truth always is, somewhere in between. I think it's closer to the first because I don't view it as a Barcelona collapse. I view it perhaps more as a self-inflicted implosion that could be corrected, but obviously for this year's European Championship, it won't be corrected in time. And it's been really strange. I was just talking to my son. We were just flicking back and forth through the Europa League games today and watching Marseille and Salzburg and CSKA, and I don't know if someone put something in the water in Europe this week, but this has been one of the most exciting quarterfinal rounds in Europe that I can recall, because big leads all around, road goals, et cetera, and it just seems as though no one cares, and I think that's good for the game. We've talked about this. In fact, I think you and I have even exchanged a few Twitter conversations, David, but in regards to the stratification of soccer in this world. And in some ways, to a negative to Serie A and to Calcio, the fact that you end up having the Bayerns and the Reals and the Manchester Cities and I guess you could throw United in there and Barcelona, et cetera. You kind of have this top six, seven, maybe if you expand it out to 10, and perhaps a Juventus would sneak in. But with financial fair play, doing exactly what it was designed to do, which is to make it very hard for anyone else to join the neighborhood. It's amazing. I thought days like what we have seen over the last three were long gone. But when you consider what we saw from Roma, and I know we're going to talk about more specifics later, what we almost saw from Juventus and all the Europa stuff going on, it's nice. It gives you a little bit more hope as a football fan.
Without a doubt. So one thing too that I wanted to ask you is, you know, I think the Italian teams 2 years in a row of they get Barcelona in the quarterfinals. I think both times, especially with Roma, they felt like huge underdogs, but we've seen Juve beat Barca decisively last year. Roma squeaked by, but I thought overall they were the better team over the two matches. Do you think the fact that both times an Italian team took them out, does that say more that maybe the Italian league is finally once again on the rise? Or does this say more about a potential relative weakness on the recent Barcelona teams from the past 2 years?
Great question, David. And again, I think it's both. In regards to Barcelona, we've seen this in La Liga before as well from the likes of, say, an Atletico Madrid or an Eibar, some of the other teams that basically come in and try and attack. What we saw a little bit from Liverpool against Manchester City, the man who kind of created this Barcelona. And I do think that Roma and Juventus, just through their Serie A experience, very intelligent, tactical league, they were able to take advantage of a weakness that Barcelona has that many other good clubs are not able to take advantage of. Still, I guarantee you, Barcelona, maybe they thought it would be a little tricky, but to get Roma when the ping pong balls came out, I have a feeling they felt better at that than they would have with some of the other potential draws, but obviously it didn't quite work out that way. So from a Barcelona perspective, there's an obvious weakness when the pressure comes on, and especially with this Barcelona, where you have a diminishing Iniesta, an absent Xavi, an ailing Busquets, and a transitioning Messi, you really need to get a lot from the others, be that a Coutinho, unavailable, Suarez, who's very enigmatic, never really sure which Luis Suarez is going to show up, and Dembele, who for some reason was kept as the last bullet in the belt and didn't come in until late enough and still almost was able to salvage Barcelona's blushes. So, again, I think this is a self-inflicted wound. I think Roma was able to take advantage. Juventus last year able to take advantage. But I almost view this as, and I think I said it on SiriusXM FC yesterday, but in regards to a judo move, that Ernesto Valverde's strength was used against him as a weakness. Very pragmatic, disciplined, organized manager.
Yeah.
But he's driving a Ferrari. Just hit the pedal to the metal and let it go. And I think they might have had a chance to run over Roma. But just the fact that they were trying to nurse the lead, and especially when things started to go wrong midway through the second half, you kind of had the feeling of inevitability.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was preparing our interview a few days ago. I have to be honest, with both matches, I almost felt like it was a fait accompli that the Italian teams would both be going out. So the tone of these questions might sound a little bit off, but I still want to ask them because they are pretty relevant. I mean, regardless of what we saw from Barca and Juve's strong performance against Real Madrid, there's no denying that in recent years, the Spanish teams have really dominated in Europe competition. So I want to ask you two things. A, do you think there's something specific to what the Spanish teams are doing that allows them to do so well on the European competition? And do you also think that does that say something about the relative strength of a league, or is that more to do with the mentality? So I want to get your take on this subject.
Again, I hate to say both, but when you take a look at the mentality, unlike Serie A, at least until recently, Italian teams don't really pay attention to the Europa. It's almost as though it's a bother or an insult. Maybe you see it from some of the English teams, especially in the early rounds. It gives you a chance to play some reserves and some kids. But even the English teams, I think, have started to come around. And obviously with Manchester United earning a berth into the Champions League through the Europa last year, I think that's opened the eyes. And we're seeing a little bit more focus from the Italian teams, although maybe not enough from Lazio today. But you take a look at just the mentality. And I do think it goes into the actual mentality of Italian versus Spanish culture, in the fact that the Spaniards, regardless of whatever competition they are in, they're going to try and do well. They're going to try and, I'm not going to say recklessly, but they will try and put out their best, and they will try and find ways to come out on top, where it's, again, a bit more of a, or has been in historical terms, a more pragmatic approach from the Italians, who are more worried about positioning, and especially with only three berths up until recently, positioning and Scudettos. So, You take a look at what's happened, though, in recent years, and I think that's changing with what Lazio has done this season. Even to get to this point was good. I think what we're seeing from the likes of a Napoli and a Juventus, a Roma, the rebuilding efforts from a Milan or an Inter. And I mean, just take a look at Milan, for example, and they might be in this position next year of popping into
a Europa League run. You're going to tell me Gennaro Gattuso isn't going to go for victory every single game? I mean, that's the mentality that needs to happen. And I think with the maybe a more passive look from a Di Francesco, but I guess a similar outlook, we saw that with Sassuolo. You see it with Napoli going back to the Empoli days with Sarri. I think the modest upbringing of some of these coaches is giving a big lift to some of these big clubs who thought they were too good for it. And I think it's a Gattuso punch in the nose in some ways, just to get the focus back on this. Now, admittedly, with the adjustment of the coefficients and the enlargement of the Champions League group stage, it'll be interesting to see how this transitions in the future, because there's not as much to fight for. But I do think that the mentality has changed. We've seen it over the past couple of years through youth development and the emergence of some really promising Italian youngsters. And that's the big difference. I mean, you take a look at Juventus, you take a look at Roma. They are international clubs, David. You would know that there's a few Italians spotted in here or there, but they tend to be modest reclamation projects.
Absolutely.
And even Juventus, they'll go out and grab a Sami Khedira when he's not wanted at Real Madrid and get something good out of him. So I think we're not quite at that stage, but with the Agnelli family feeling a little bit of pressure, if Ross steps in Milan with Tohir apparently looking to cut bait in both DC and at Inter, depending upon what happens there, I think that we're starting to see an influx of money that could only be to the benefit of Serie A and the Serie A fans, because I think they've had to tighten their belt. They've had to look for other ways, and that's led to, I don't want to say a golden generation, because it might turn out to be fool's gold, but the promise of a golden generation of new Italian talent. And now if you can go out and grab one or two upcoming international players and throw them into the mix, obviously having one and almost two teams in the semifinals of the European Championship is a sign that Calcio's back.
Absolutely. So this is the last question I want to ask you on Calcio, because I have a question on MLS that's been on my mind for a while. You mentioned a little bit about Napoli. So I want to ask you as a general question, not really specific to them, but do you think it's realistic for a team that plays attractive, fun, offensive style of football like Napoli to win a league? Because there's a lot of controversy on this. People that follow Serie A, they say, well, you can't win playing that style. I'm of the opinion that the reason they haven't won has a lot more to do with Juve's strength, especially domestically. I mean, I've seen some other teams, Sacchi's Milan, play pretty similar in winning, but maybe it's a little bit harder with that style. So I wanted to get your take on that. Do you think style of play and the way Sarri plays is less conducive to winning a league, or is it flat out impossible in the modern game to do it playing that way?
Well, Barcelona did pretty well for about 5 or 6 years. And it's not as though Bayern Munich, even though they are German, it's not like they're driving around in a Volkswagen in first gear. So I think other leagues, and Manchester City, they learned a hard lesson. But there's no doubt, number one, that the pocketbooks will be opened again, and Pep Guardiola will come back hungrier again. And with the likes of Phil Foden, they'll be able to even bring up some of their own as well. I think that you can play attractive soccer. You almost have to play attractive soccer. And I know some people maybe don't give enough credit to Juventus for the way that they play. I mentioned it on the broadcast to Canada yesterday. Ray and I were fortunate enough to be able to call these two games to be in sports up in Canada. And it was a bit eye-opening because to this point, the games I've done from Juventus up to these last two have all been Serie A. And they play away in Italy. And this was the whole Conte situation. He was unable to make the switch. Allegri has been. In Europe, they play a much more composed, controlled, counter-attacking formation. They don't want to get the cheap goal scored against them. They use their tactics, which I love. I mean, it's nothing really fancy. It's something even MLS with Chris Wondolowski was doing. But the target wing, when you have a guy that's 6'3" going in on a fullback from the backside for a header, we saw it from Mandzukic once and a couple of times, actually, yesterday. That's putting your pieces in position to win. So I don't want to take credit away from Juventus, even though they play a little tighter to the vest in Europe. Yeah. With Napoli, they also have played maybe a little less free-for-all, a little less reckless than they did the year before, maybe learning a few lessons along the way, which is one reason they're still in the mix. In my mind, it has nothing to do with style. It has more to do with personnel. I love the fact that Sarri doesn't want prima donnas. He doesn't want players that are not willing to buy into the system. But two things. They need a plan B, just like Barcelona went out and got a Luis Suarez. You can't rely on Dries Mertens all the time. And I'm not quite sure they've fully developed that plan B at this point. And you also need a little bit more depth. When you're going to be playing 60 games or more a season, asking 15 or 16 guys to play the vast majority of those is asking a lot. So part of me would love to see him move to England and take over Arsenal. Although with the Gunners still in the running for Europa, I kind of have a feeling we're going to have Arsene Wenger for one more year. Yeah. But part of me also would like to see this Napoli side take the next step, find a good, promising target forward who can play in this system and then also adapt to another style, to find a little bit more depth in the midfield. To the point where you're not playing exhausted players when you're playing 6-7 games over a 2-week span. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Sarri. Just like Pep Guardiola has made no secret, whenever he can, he pops the Napoli tapes in just to find out what the latest wrinkle is. In some ways, the way Pep was, in some ways, the way Bielsa was. He is a genius. Now,
he is.
Sometimes that does not work. You just take a look at Bielsa, and he just can't deal with mere mortals. I think the fact that Sarri got such a late start at this stage of the game leads him to understand how the world works. He has a much better personality. He's much more, for lack of a better word, forgiving, I guess. Still focused, still determined, but mere mortals don't bother him as much as it does others. I think he'll do fine. I like I said, I'd love to see him somewhere else, selfishly at Arsenal, but part of me would really love to see him get another year or two and two or three more transfer windows for opportune, targeted buys to see what this Napoli team could really become.
Absolutely. So let me ask you one MLS question, because I'm not an expert, certainly nowhere near the level of knowledge you have on the league. But I have to say, I was kind of in the corner that I wasn't that thrilled when I heard that Ibrahimovic was coming to MLS. Obviously, he's a great player, brings a lot of attention to the league. But, you know, what I've enjoyed watching in MLS in the past few years, and I got into it, you know, when Pirlo came here, and, you know, it really didn't work out with him, but I started getting into New York City FC. I like some of the younger players. I look at what Toronto, what's going on there, and they've targeted younger players from Europe. I think this team, Toronto, is fantastic. I had Alexi Lalas on the podcast, and he told me flat out, this Toronto team could have beaten the Padova that he played, and this was Serie A in the 90s. So I feel like those are really the storylines to talk about, what Atlanta has done with a lot of young players. We're seeing the teams in LA going with young players. So do you feel like this Zlatan arrival in a lot of ways is like feeding the narrative that MLS is a retirement league, or am I making way too much about it and I should just enjoy the ride and the fact that Zlatan is bringing more eyeballs to the league?
Well, we still have to wait and see what happens. We're only two games in. But it seems to be sit back and shut up, David. But in my mind, I can understand your fear. And I don't blame Pirlo. I don't particularly blame Lampard. I do blame Gerrard a little bit, because it seemed like he knew what he was getting in for and didn't want to do it as soon as he signed the contract. With Lampard, injuries played a role. With Pirlo, worst possible team. Tight confines, rookie team, guys that can barely trap the ball. And I think if you would have put him into maybe a team that was on its last legs of sort with a with that style, like a Real Salt Lake, put him into maybe not on the turf, but a team that actually had some aggressive attacking talent, like a Seattle, like a Portland, I think Andrea Pirlo would probably still be playing and they'd be lauding him and building statues. But playing in the tight confines with a team that was still learning how to walk was a disaster waiting to happen. Now, as far as Ibrahimovic goes, only David Beckham has brought more headlines. And the thing with Beckham, it seemed like every single section of the newspaper around the world had a David Beckham story when he moved to MLS. How would it affect like Armani sales and what was going to happen with the Spice Girls? Would they be coming back? It just was a way to grab the world's eyeballs. However, with Zlatan Ibrahimovic, it's a little more focused on the sports pages, and it is still grabbing the attention. I mentioned this earlier on Extra, I believe, one of these days. It might have been on Sirius XMFC. But it's similar to Ray Hudson in the fact that Zlatan is such a personality. There are reporters, there are television crews and radio crews that are going to the games, not even to watch the game, just to stick a mic in his face afterwards to find out what's going to happen. So in my mind, you need those headliners. You need superstars, aging or otherwise, to get people in the door the first time, to get the headlines, to get the top story on the news that night, to get people excited. However, it desperately needs to have something in addition to that, which is some steak with the sizzle. And there is a bit of that in Los Angeles. I'm not quite sure that Siggy Schmidt is the guy to bring it out, although I think he's a lot readier than he would have been 6 or 7 years ago in regards to dealing with the circus that's going to come with Ibrahimovic. But there's going to need to be a few changes here or there. I love Alessandrini, in my mind, one of the most underrated players in the league. I think that this gives a kick in the pants to the Dos Santos brothers, especially Gio. I think Jonathan is an honest player. Gio sometimes coasts. Zlatan's not going to allow that as much. So I think if you put him in, if you continue to try and develop your own, especially defensively, because that's where there's a huge weakness in Los Angeles, and you get people in the stands the first time, and then everyone else gives them a reason to come back, that's great. So I admit I shared a little bit of concern, but I saw what he was able to do at PSG when people thought he was over the hill. I saw what he's able to do at Manchester United before the injury when people thought he was over the hill. So when I saw the fact that he was healthy again and hungry again, I knew that he'd be ready. Now, is he going to play on artificial turf? I'd be really hesitant to say yes. I'd really hesitate to say I'd like to see him there because it's just asking for more wear and tear and less Ibra in the long haul. But this is an opportunity. It's not success. This gives you a chance, as I said, to get people's interest, but now you have to do something with it.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't hurt the fact that there's a few television contracts and sponsorships that are up for renewal that will probably be signed a little quicker and maybe for a little more with Ibrahimovic, plus what's going on in Atlanta and the like, than it would have without.
You've talked me off the ledge. I'm in now. Thanks so much. So, Phil, you were really incredible. I'm already have so many questions for the next time that I'd love to have you on, assuming you agree to come on, because I want to dedicate a good amount of time to get into your career in broadcasting. Now, everyone that's listening to the podcast can hear your fantastic announcer voice, which is tremendous, but there's so much more that goes into the job. So tell our listeners real quickly, how do you prepare for a live game? And you work with Ray, so that's got to be quite exciting. And then tell me, what advice would you give to someone that wants to do your job down the road?
Well, it's kind of intriguing, just because a few weeks back, a young announcer got his debut chance doing some radio play-by-play for a soccer game and asked me for some advice. That's a little bit more specific, a little bit more targeted to other announcers. But if you look on back on my Twitter timeline, I think I have it on my Facebook official page, have it on my LinkedIn page, if you can get to that. It was like my starting 11 rules for broadcasting. And I even ended up, after some thought, putting three substitutes on the bench as well. Like, for example, you're never bigger than the game. And basically, I think the first rule was be over-prepared, even if you're not going to use it all, because you never know what's going to happen. But I'd recommend people take a look. I would also let people know that, be it on Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn, however they want to get in touch, more than willing to chat and communicate and pass along advice if I'm able. I think there's two points that really jump out. Number one is it's not easy and it takes time and it's a lot more painful than it might appear in the process, but I wouldn't trade a moment. I am blessed to be able to do what I have done, but there have been a few tests along the way. I passed a few, I guess I passed enough. And I am just, as I said, blessed to be able to go into work every day and do something that I love. But you have to be willing. I'm reminded of a story, I believe it's true, but Dan Rather, back before his disgrace, went back to the University of Missouri in Columbia to give a commencement address. And they had him up there congratulating all of the graduates. And then he started talking about all of the problems when you start out in this journalism business, be it sports or news, and the fact there's so much divorce and so many alcoholics and so much drug abuse and even to the point of suicide in some cases, but just giving over every little negative detail that you wouldn't imagine would be highlighted at a commencement address. And you could just almost imagine the dean's jaw dropping to the floor in the background. And at the end, he congratulates the graduates again, wishes them the best. And the dean comes over and said, "Why did you say that?" And he said, "Anyone who changed their mind because of what I said wouldn't have made it in the first place." So you need to have the passion. You need to understand that it's not going to be easy and you need to stay focused in on the goal. There are going to be a few things that might be described as lucky breaks. There's going to be a few people along the way that could be described as mentors, but a lot of this ends up coming from inside. Are you willing to make the effort? Are you willing to stick around and do high school basketball or to even just carry the equipment for someone doing a small college broadcast? Take every advantage you can, even if it's not professional. Go to the local high school, the local college, community college, grab a tape recorder or do it on your phone and just sit up in the upper deck and start calling the game. And then I would recommend, like, maybe a week or two later, not right away, because the same mistakes that you made will still be kind of fresh in your mind. So if you just listen to it right away, you're not going to notice something. So you wait a week or two, and if you can see the ball, if you can know what the circumstances were, you did an okay job. So never let anyone tell you you can't. If you really want to do it, just understand it's going to take a lot of hard work. But if you love it, it's not work at all.
Awesome. Well, listen, Phil, this was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I hope you're willing to come back on, because there's so many other questions that I have. But thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, definitely check out Phil's fantastic work. I really enjoyed this, so thanks again for joining us.
Anytime, David, and thank you for all of the help that you've provided along the years, and anytime, I'd be more than happy.